years, Joel and I supported each other's TV projects. He was Sabrina's magic supervisor, and I wrote on The TV Wheel, his sketch comedy pilot for HBO. Eventually, we got pulled in different creative directions. We stayed friends, but didn't work together again until 2017, when Joel revived MST3K and invited me to write on a couple of episodes. It was like getting a chance to play for the 75 Red Sox. Writing with Joel was mostly a clever excuse to spend time with him. I think a lot of successful collaborations boil down to people who just enjoy being together. That's true for everyone I've teamed up with. Walking into a room and seeing A. Scott Berg, Doug Copeland, Ian Stokes, Rob Bragan, Tim Carvel, or my sister Claire makes me instantly happy. Shifting between a duo and a solo career has helped me appreciate both. It's great to have a brilliant partner who shares the burden of generating ideas and dialogue. And it's great to write without a partner and not have to litigate every fucking line. Collaboration is like canoeing. Both paddlers need to row at the same speed and in the same direction. In some collaborations, one paddler steers and sets the pace. In others, the paddlers are perfectly synchronized. If the partnership works, the canoe glides through the water. If it doesn't, the canoe goes in circles. I get why so many writers are drawn to collaboration, especially at the start of their careers. When you're insecure, it helps to have a partner say, "That's funny. Put it in the script." The downside of a partnership is splitting a paycheck. The upside is easing the loneliness of writing and imposing some discipline. Writers struggle to motivate themselves. If you don't believe me, I have 3 half-written feature scripts to show you. Having a partner who depends on you raises the stakes and forces you to deliver. No writer wants to let down someone they love and respect, but letting yourself down? That's just Tuesday. Joel's and my meet-cute turned out to be less rom and more calm. Still, those early days when I was falling in love made me realize that after years of focusing on my career, I craved having someone to come home to. Pickings were slim in L.A. Director Mike Nichols used to say that every relationship needed a gardener and a flower. I definitely wanted to be the flower. But how would I find a gardener in the desert? Chapter 9. We're All Oompa Loompas. Oh my God, you're working on the Muppets? That show must be so much fun to write for. People who don't work in Hollywood. You're probably familiar with physicist Erwin Schrödinger's thought experiment involving a hypothetical box, some radioactive material, and a hapless cat. But you might not know that Schrödinger's cat also reveals 2 fundamental truths about Hollywood. First, Schrödinger's experiment suggests that the act of observing a dynamic changes the dynamic. The same is true for a writer's room. Sometimes a journalist will try to capture the experience of being a TV writer with an article entitled "A Day in the Fill in the Show Room" or even "A Week in the Fill in the Show Room." But until you've spent 8 soul-crushing months in the Fill in the Show Room, you can't understand what it's like. An outsider isn't privy to the venting in the parking garage, or a coworker pantomiming blowing his brains out in the snack room. A writer's room is like a family, and we all know that families act differently when they have company. Schrödinger's experiment also illustrates the absurdity of quantum mechanics, because until the lid of the box is lifted, the cat inside is simultaneously dead and alive. This brings us to the second truth of the writer's room. Working on a TV show is simultaneously fun and not fun. When people conclude that it must be so much fun to work on the Muppets, it's like assuming the Oompa Loompas love every minute working at Willy Wonka's chocolate factory. To outsiders, it's all chocolate waterfalls and funny songs. But late at night, Someone's got to clean up after all those nut-testing squirrels. And let's just say the nuts are very high in fiber. On the plus side, I can't think of another workplace where job performance is tied to how hard you can make your coworkers laugh. Perks include high salaries, low risk of injury, sweet snacks, salty snacks, and the chance to hang out with pop culture icons like Mana Mana and his backup singers, the Snouts. The ratio of fun versus not fun varies from show to show and depends on what I call the three P's. The people, the process, and the product. It's a rarity to work on a show where all three P's are consistently satisfying. You're lucky if you get two out of three. More often, you settle for one. The people, process, and product are the factors that determine any employee's happiness. Here's a breakdown of Hollywood's unique spin on office culture. People. Every show starts off a delight. The first week is like a group date with writers sharing well-honed stories about former jobs, nightmare relationships, and bouts of diarrhea. Fathers talk openly about their children, while mothers often downplay theirs. If asked whether I have kids, I usually reply, "I've got two sons, but I'm blanking on their names right now." As work gets more pressured, the ease of the early casual weeks falls away. Personalities clash, factions form, and every day feels like Thanksgiving with your dysfunctional family. The showrunner sets the tone, which bakes a potential problem right into the free bagels. Most showrunners begin their careers as writers, spending a lot of time in their heads. As they move up the production ladder, writers expand their skill set, learning how to cast, edit, approve wardrobe, etc. At no point are writers taught how to manage people. Eventually, the writer who was good at ordering around characters in his head ends up in charge of actual human beings. The Writers Guild recognized this oversight and created a showrunner's training program to help teach management techniques to members. But not all the necessary skills, like empathy and generosity, can be easily taught. Good luck trying to explain personal boundaries to a showrunner who starts a Monday morning meeting with, "The weirdest thing happened this weekend. I had a wet dream and woke up with a load in my pants." Now, this showrunner has every right to share his touching story. That's not just my opinion. It's the ruling of the California Supreme Court. In 2006, a Friends writer's assistant charged that lewd talk in the room constituted sexual harassment. The Friends writing staff denied the charge and argued that lewd talk was often part of the creative process. The justices sided with the writers and dismissed the suit. Every TV writer breathed a sigh of relief. Writers need to feel safe and comfortable enough to push boundaries and find comedy. If someone wants to divulge that his father is a chronic masturbator, that's fine. The only risk that information should carry is when his father visits the office and shakes everyone's hand, there will be a lot of Purell jokes. Still, there's a difference between allowing people to share personal information and forcing them to. The same showrunner who talked about his wet dream once went around the table and asked all the writers to reveal the age at which they lost their virginity. I declined. The question wasn't relevant to the show and the context wasn't work-related. The lower-level writers all answered, even though some seemed reluctant. Then the showrunner launched into his own tale, which was more horrifying than amusing. That white, straight, male showrunner missed the irony that the discussion that made him feel safe and comfortable might make a more vulnerable person feel trapped and targeted. Fortunately, I witnessed early on how a great showrunner operates. My coach boss, Barry Kemp, displayed the five qualities that you hope to find in a leader in any field. A great leader, 1, understands the mission better than anyone in the room and can communicate it. 2, is the hardest working person in the room. 3, is the most generous person in the room, not just with compensation, but also with praise and credit. 4, allows dissent and even invites it. 5. Listens and learns. Barry hit all these points while still being the funniest person in the room. He was also flawlessly polite. If a joke fell flat during a table read, Barry would make a small question mark in the margin. After the read, we'd return to the room and start the rewrite. When we got to the page with a question mark next to a joke, Barry would ask for new pitches. Sometimes the writer would blame the actor for blowing the line and lobby for a second shot. Barry would nicely but firmly say, "Let's try something new." This went on for months until one day I figured out the code. Barry's question mark meant no. But where most showrunners don't think twice about slashing a line through dialogue or X-ing an entire page, Barry even respected the work that goes into a failed joke. Barry's decency and thoughtfulness made him an outstanding mentor. When I was running Sabrina, I struggled to find ways to keep the room energized, so I sought Barry's advice on how to motivate a staff. "I like to treat the writer's room like a cocktail party," he told me. "I start with a funny story and warm people up, and then shift to work and they don't even notice." Oh my God, that's exactly what he did. I sat in his room for over 2 years and never noticed the elegant and sly manipulation. The only problem was that the cocktail party blueprint suited Barry, who was a natural wreck on tour. His advice wouldn't work for me, so I sought out a second opinion from Corby Siamis, my equally wonderful boss at Murphy Brown. Corby had a slightly different take. "You want to know the best way to keep writers motivated?" she said. "Tell them they're fucking lucky to have jobs." Barry offered a carrot. Corby offered a stick. I ended up somewhere in the middle. A carrot stick? Process. When writers who work on different series get together, their first question is always, "How are the hours?" Long hours are a sure way to make a fun job less fun. I enjoyed my 3 freelance assignments at Monk in part because showrunner Andy Breckman ran the room so efficiently. The detective show was shot in L.A., but the writer's room was located near Andy's home in New Jersey. Arriving for the first time at the offices, via PATH train, I thought I'd come to the wrong place. The building also housed a medical lab, and I had to step over metal specimen containers to reach the elevator. Operating outside Hollywood's sphere gave Monk a different feel. No one was reading the trades, and the small staff buckled down and stayed focused. Andy also ran one of the funniest rooms that I've ever sat in. Once, the subject of time travel came up, and Andy tossed out a perfect sci-fi story. What if I went back to kill Hitler in Germany, but when I arrived, he was in the middle of a speech and I had to wait? And as I listened, I started thinking, you know, he's making some good points. The Rhineland is pretty nice. And next thing I know, I'm goose-stepping with the army and saying Sieg Heil, and that's when I realized that the whole Third Reich is made up of time travelers who came back to kill Hitler and decided to join him instead. I always enjoy tangents from funny storytellers, but some rooms spend so much time ordering lunch and watching videos that it's suddenly 3 o'clock and the script has barely been touched. And sometimes staying late has nothing to do with work at all. One showrunner who was single used to keep writers around so he had company while he watched Letterman. Even worse, this was back when Dave was on at 12:30 a.m. After inquiring about work hours, writers will inevitably ask each other, "And how's the network treating you?" Entire books are devoted to cataloging ridiculous script notes from executives. When I assumed the helm at Sabrina, showrunner Eileen Heisler advised me to get good at nodding my head and saying, "I'll take a look at that." "Don't argue with the network," Eileen warned. "You will never convince them that you're right and they're wrong." She shared her trick for dealing with these situations. "I just keep asking questions. Why do you think that? Where do the scenes start feeling off to you? Make them pinpoint the problem so you can solve it. Sometimes it's just one line that needs to change." I've also worked with some insightful and inspiring network executives who make every project better. CBS's steady success over the past 20 years can be largely credited to longtime entertainment president Nina Tassler. I've worked on several pilots with Nina, including a light drama, which was pitched to me as Clueless meets CSI. After reading my first draft, Nina called to give notes. Her voice sounded upbeat without a hint of disapproval. She had loved the A, main story, but had problems with the B, secondary story. "It just didn't grab me as much," she said, "and I'd love for you to come up with something else because I just want the B story to be as good as the A." "Of course," I said. I totally get it. We batted around some other ideas, and after landing on one that Nina liked, I thanked her for the feedback and hung up the phone, smiling. A minute later, it hit me. Nina had just tossed out my entire B story, and I had thanked her. That's how good she is. Stars are another major variable in the production process. At Charmed, the writers would watch dailies, scenes filmed the previous day, in shock as one actress openly insulted the writers with the cameras rolling. "I'm not saying this line," one witch said. "It's stupid." So first, had she seen the show? And second, creating a character works best as a symbiosis between actors and writers. When that relationship breaks down, the product suffers. Of course, writers can be tone-deaf with actors, too. At NCIS, I got called to set once when Mark Harmon had an issue with some dialogue I'd written. Mark is a consummate professional, and that show is a massive success, not just because of what he does on screen, but because of what he does off. When I arrived on set, Mark, Lieutenant Gibbs, was holding his sides, the pages from the script being shot that day. "Maybe you can help me," Mark said. "I'm stumbling over this scene, specifically this line." He pointed and I peered. The director hovered anxiously. This discussion was eating up precious shooting time. I asked Mark if I could hear him say the line. He gamely complied. "That sounds fine," I said, genuinely not seeing the problem. "Really?" Mark said. "It doesn't feel right to me. Sounds a little weak." "I don't think it's weak," I said. "It's vulnerable. Gibbs even admits that he's puzzled." Mark frowned a bit. The actress in the scene was a semi-regular and joined the conversation. "I think it sounds fine," she said helpfully. Mark glanced over at the director, who was eager to roll camera. Mark came to a decision. "All right," he said. "I'll give it a try." I can still see Mark shaking his head slightly as he walked back into the set. Now, some actors will purposely tank a line to prove a writer wrong. Not Mark Harmon. He delivered the line as written and 100% made it work. Still, I look back on the way I acted that day and cringe. The same way Barry used to put a question mark that meant no, Mark was being respectful. Without demanding a new line, he made it clear that's what he needed. I'm ashamed that I was too locked into my own intention and too worried about the time. I had listened to respond, not listened to understand. Product. No TV writer ever admits to working on a bad show and will bend themselves into paper clips to justify their time and effort. "The show's dumb but fun," they'll say. Or, "The first drafts are great, but the network's noting us to death." Some even blame the space-time continuum. "I just don't think the audience is ready for this show yet." I would like to break this pattern by admitting that I've worked on bad shows. Maybe even terrible ones. And yet despite their badness, some were very popular. You don't always get to work on shows that suit your personal taste. And the shows that do suit your taste don't always work out. I fell hard for The War Next Door, a sitcom created by Chris Viscardi and Will McRobb. Originally titled Kill, 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 the show centered on a clean-cut CIA agent who retires to a quiet life in the suburbs until his arch-nemesis moves into the house next door. I'd met the showrunners at a one-day punch-up session on their hit movie Snow Day and was thrilled when they asked me to write a freelance episode. The War Next Door had an absurdist, get-smart vibe. We broke the story in a group and I happily fleshed out scenes where grown men tried to strangle each other with garden hoses. That episode, and Baby Makes Death, turned out well, and Will and Chris asked me if I wanted to tackle the two-part season finale. I said yes and poured my heart into the scripts. The episodes were cleverly produced, and I was truly proud to have my name on them. USA canceled the show before that two-parter ever aired. I've had the opposite experience, too. In 2007, I was part of a three-writer tag team working on an NCIS story about a killer car developed by DARPA. There are times that scripts are written quickly and turn out fine. This was not one of them. We all shared writing credit, but when the episode aired, I didn't alert my family or my agent. It seemed better to let that one pass unnoticed. Driven turned out to be the highest-rated program on TV that week. In my entire career, it's the only time my name has appeared on the week's number one show. All together now. Murphy Brown, starring the sublime Candace Bergen, was the only time in 30 years where all three P's came together. When my contract at Coach was up, I wanted to jump to a new series, preferably one with more female voices on screen and off. Murphy showrunners Gary Donzig, Steve Peterman, and Corby Siamis read my material and called me in. When I walked into their airy office on the Warner Brothers lot, Corby was seated, her skinny legs casually flung over the side of the armchair. She waved hello but made no move to stand. Steve was behind the desk, and Gary sat on the couch. The meeting was fun and relaxed. When I got up to leave, Corby stood to shake my hand, and that's when I noticed she had a basketball under her shirt. Weird, I thought. Why would someone put a basketball under their shirt? Corby noticed my confused expression because she gestured toward the basketball and said, "Oh yeah, I'm pregnant." Of course. My brain hadn't been able to make sense of the obvious. Corby explained the baby was due over hiatus, so she'd be back in the room by the time the sixth season started. It was a life-changing moment for me. An executive producer was not just pregnant. She was nonchalantly pregnant. I want to be nonchalantly pregnant someday, too, I thought while getting into my car. Murphy hired me as supervising producer. When I walked in the first day and saw three other women sitting at the table, my heart leapt. After years at Coach and Late Night and Newhart and Smothers Brothers, it felt so good to be on a staff where I didn't have the additional role of representing all women. I could just be me. Like Mark Harmon, Candace Bergen set the tone on the stage. She was professional, generous, and respectful to all. At Murphy, scenes were automatically shot twice in front of an audience. One night, Candace nailed 95% of her dialogue on the first try, but fumbled one joke. I'd co-written the episode with Rob Bragan, and we were standing on set, trying to decide if it was worth mentioning the bobble to the director. Just then, Candace strode by. "I blew that line," she said as she passed. "Watch me go get it." She got it. The high level of performance attracted high-level guest stars. I wrote an episode about a member of the original FYI news team, the fifth anchor, who was fired for being annoying. Stuart Best, a combination of Stuart Sutcliffe and Pete Best, returns for a reunion special and to figure out who got him shit-canned. Spoiler alert, it was mostly Murphy. The network wanted John Ratzenberger from Cheers to play the part, but the writers were all rooting for Wallace, inconceivable, Sean. Ratzenberger fell out, or was he pushed? And Wally stepped in to delight us all. The fourth P, personal life. My fond memories of Murphy are colored by a happy personal development that same year. At the last moment, the show needed a guest star to play a Howard Stern-type character, and someone suggested Penn Jillette. I volunteered to contact him directly to see if he was available. He wasn't, but he invited me to hang out with him in Vegas that weekend. He and Teller were committed to moving west, and Penn was flying in with his architect to look at some land. I headed to Vegas on a Saturday morning and caught up with Penn and his, "Wow, he's really cute," architect, Colin Summers. Colin was a recent graduate of Cornell's College of Architecture, and I'd seen him around the P&T offices where he doubled as Penn's computer geek. Penn, Colin, and I fell into an instant rapport as we tramped around the desert. That night, the three of us went to a gentleman's club to watch a performance by Penn's friend, Venus Delight. Pretty sure that's not her real name. As Venus slid around a gigantic martini glass, Colin and I got to know each other. Where rom-com meet-cutes had failed me, hardcore reality came through. Nothing in my past would have suggested that I'd fall in love in a strip club in Vegas, but that's what happened. Colin and I made plans to meet early the next morning for a joint rollerblade, him, and run, me, along the strip. He was faster, so he'd circle back, gliding gracefully around me while talking about architecture, music, and technology. My head was spinning. Colin drove me to the airport that afternoon. The night before, we discovered that we both enjoyed the movie True Romance. When Colin dropped me off, I slipped a note into his bag that repeated what Patricia Arquette said over and over to Christian Slater. "You're so cool." A few months later, Colin moved from New York City to Vegas to design Penn's house. On weekends, he'd ride his motorcycle to L.A. so we could be together. After 6 months, the subject of having kids came up. I was conflicted. At 33, I wanted a family, but I didn't want to stop working. Then Colin said the sexiest thing I'd ever heard a man say. "I'd be happy to stay home and take care of a baby for the first year." "Seriously?" "Seems fair. You carry the baby for the first 9 months and I'll carry it for the second." I was making good money, especially when compared to a budding architect, so the arrangement made financial sense. Still, the best part of Colin's offer is that he didn't make it solely for financial reasons. He truly wanted to be the primary caregiver. A year after meeting Colin, I got my wish and became nonchalantly pregnant. I built a baby while Colin built a gorgeous house for Penn known as the Slammer. About a month before I gave birth, Colin moved to L.A. full-time. Once Rudy arrived, Colin settled happily into his new role, returning to architecture when an interesting project cropped up. Pretty amazing, right? Unless you reverse the gender, and then it's what women who have the choice to stay home do 95% of the time. Colin and I originally rejected the idea of getting married. Our relationship, our rules. But by the time I became pregnant with our second son, we were living in Brentwood and owned a Volvo. You can't get more married than that, so we decided to make it official. Our wedding consisted of three people: the bride, the groom, and the magician who married us in our backyard. Everything about that year on Murphy Brown was magical, so of course it couldn't last. Steve, Gary, and Corby moved on at the end of the season, leaving the showrunner's slot open. I secretly hoped that the three highest-ranking writers, which included me, would be promoted. Instead, Warner Brothers brought in an outsider. The studio gave me an opening to leave, and I took it. Securing another job didn't worry me. I was solidly in the get-me-Nell-Scovell stage of my career. Plus, a year on Murphy Brown and finding Colin had helped build my self-esteem. I felt ready to create my own show. Chapter 10. So you want to run a TV show. Interior, Sabrina's bedroom. Night. Sabrina. Salem, do you think the council will grant the time reversal? Salem the cat. I'm the wrong witch to ask. They weren't very lenient to me. Sentenced to 100 years as a cat. And for what? Sabrina. I don't know. For what? Salem the cat. Oh, like any young kid, I dreamed of world domination. Of course, they really crack down when you act on it. Sabrina. Wow. No wonder you're so possessive of the sofa. Sabrina the teenage witch. Pilot. As a first-time showrunner and creator, I felt strangely confident going into the table read of the pilot episode of Sabrina the Teenage Witch. I felt good about the script. I felt good about the cast. I felt good about the director. The only thing I did not feel good about was that I had to kick off the table read by giving a speech. Public speaking is hard for me. My heart starts to pound and my voice gets all quivery. It worried me that if I seemed nervous, it would set a bad tone. I considered delegating the speech to someone else, but no one knew better than I did what made Sabrina special. After all, how many shows had a talking cat? Then it hit me like a ton of sticks. I had a plan. The day of the read, the crowd filed in. Viacom President Perry Simon patted me on the back and flashed me his impish smile. I waved to our director, Robbie Benson, who most people know as the star of One-on-One, if male, or Ice Castles, if female, or both, if me. At a nearby table, an animatronic cat sat stiffly on a wooden plank. Crew members and writers milled around. Actors took seats and flipped through their scripts. Finally, the ABC contingent entered, led by newly named President of Entertainment Jamie Tarsis and head of scheduling Jeff Bader. Jamie was the highest-ranking person in the room, and when she took her seat, it was showtime. All eyes turned to me. Then suddenly, the stiff cat came to life. "Greetings, humans," Salem called out. Everyone lit up as the cat cranked his neck. The writers had composed a short, funny speech for Salem, who was voiced by fellow writer Nick Bakay. The cat welcomed the group, then after a few lines, started to cough and hack, trying to expel a hairball. With his last breath, Salem turned the table read over to me. After Salem's funny intro, the pressure was off. I calmly thanked the network and the studio for their support, the crew and writers for their work, and lastly, I thanked the actors. "You're all amazing," I said. "I love this cast. But please know, if you complain too much..." My voice trailed off as I gestured toward the animatronic cat, which sprang to life again. The implication was that the actors could all be replaced by fancy puppets. People laughed. I nodded to Robbie, who read the opening stage direction. Interior, Sabrina's bedroom, night. We were off. About 24 minutes later, Robbie read, "Fade out, end of show." Everyone applauded. They always do, so I didn't read anything into that. The network executives huddled in a corner while the writers, production staff, and actors headed to stage. While I waited for notes, I thought about how far we'd come in only 4 months. It all started when my new agent, Abby Adams, called to ask if I'd been a fan of the Sabrina the Teenage Witch comic books as a kid. I had. Part of the Archie universe, Sabrina was created by George Glatter. Viacom Productions turned the premise into a cable movie written by a group led by Barney Cohen. That cable movie was edited into a 4-minute presentation that Viacom shopped to networks. Ted Harbert, then president of ABC, saw Sabrina as a good fit for the family-friendly TGIF lineup and ordered 13 episodes. Easy. Not so fast. Jonathan Schmack, a gifted writer and artist, wrote a pilot script. He was slated to run the show as soon as he wrapped up his job on the already canceled Brotherly Love. Then, in a surprise move, the fledgling WB picked up his show and Jonathan was no longer available. After Murphy, I had jumped into an overall deal at 20th Century Fox Studios. Peter Roth, one of the nicest and most successful executives around, signed me to an 18-month contract to create sitcoms. The studio paired me with novelist Doug Copeland to develop his book Micro Surfs into a TV show set in the tech world. We pitched our concept to the head of the Fox network, who listened intently. "This is the most thought-out pitch I've ever heard," he told us, "and I didn't understand a word of it." Micro Surfs crashed. I rebounded and sold a concept to the WB about two high school besties with a cable show. Prudy and Judy was picked up to pilot, and we cast two phenomenal 16-year-old actresses, Jackie Tone and Laura Bell Bundy, who later originated the role of Elle Woods in the musical Legally Blonde. Barry Kemp directed, and Alan Thicke played Laura Bell's father. The WB passed on the series, which made me sad, but also freed me up to meet on Sabrina. As the new Sabrina showrunner, I was given leeway to rewrite Jonathan's pilot script, which centered on Sabrina screwing up her driver's test. I refocused the story on Sabrina discovering her magical powers and worrying about her social status. "I don't want to be special," Sabrina insists to her warlock father. "I want to be normal." "I understand," her dad responds, "but that ship has sailed." On her first day at school, Sabrina makes a series of mistakes. She gets hit in the head by a football in front of the boy she likes. She fails a pop quiz. Finally, she loses her temper in the cafeteria and uses her magic irresponsibly. The second act opens in the Spellman kitchen. Sabrina enters, panicked, holding a pineapple. "Sabrina, I hate being a witch. I just turned the most popular girl in school into a pineapple." Hilda, "Chill, I can fix this," takes a cleaver out. "Chunks or rings?" Zelda, "Hilda, there are other ways." Hilda, "Wedges?" Aunt Zelda turns the cheerleader Libby, named after my niece, back into her human form. Libby isn't sure what just went down. "You did something to me," she says. "You sent me somewhere. It was small and smelled like Hawaii." Expertly played by Jenna Lee Green, Libby storms out, promising to destroy Sabrina's reputation. And she has the power to do it. "She's a cheerleader," says Sabrina. "No one has more credibility." Desperate to undo the disastrous day, Sabrina petitions the Witches' Council to turn back time. Jonathan had written a similar scene, although in his version, the aunts and Salem accompanied Sabrina. I felt Sabrina should have to plead her case alone. I cast magicians Penn and Teller as council members Drell and Skippy, respectively. In a set inspired by surrealist art, Sabrina argues for a second chance. This scene set up the metaphor of the entire series. Being a teenager means coming into your powers, but being an adult means learning to control them. The council turns down the request. Sabrina has no choice but to go back to school and face Libby's ridicule. "Fine, I surrender," Sabrina says as she heads off the next morning. "I guess every school needs a weird kid. Might as well be me." "I was the weird kid," Hilda calls after her, cheerfully. It made my heart beat faster to hear Caroline Ray deliver this line in such a chipper voice. "I was the weird kid, too." Sabrina was my attempt to create a show that my teenage self would have watched. In the final scenes, Aunt Hilda confronts Drell and forces him to give her niece a do-over. Sabrina makes the most of her second chance. She catches the football, aces the pop quiz, and doesn't turn the cheerleader into a pineapple. At the end of the school day, Sabrina races home, triumphant. "Yay, I'm normal," she declares. "Gotta go tell the cat." Viacom execs Steve Gordon and Chris Sanagustin were true partners and helped shape my early drafts. The biggest argument we had concerned a character who's not even in the pilot, Sabrina's mom. Jonathan's script had Sabrina say, "I never knew my mom," implying mom had died in childbirth. The studio thought this was a fine way to explain mom's absence, but I didn't see any reason to kill her off. The tradition of matricide in family movies from Bambi to Finding Nemo has always rankled me. I presented my case to Steve and Chris. "Why can't we just give the mom a job that keeps her far away?" "Like what?" "What if she's an archaeologist on a long dig in Peru?" I said. "And she just abandoned her kid?" "Sabrina's not abandoned," I said. "She's living in a nice home with her two loving aunts. I mean, her dad's not with her, and you're okay with that. You're not insisting we kill him off."
"No."
"So why is it different with a mom?" Sabrina's mom got a stay of execution. Still, Steve and Chris asked me to make it clear that mom keeping her distance wasn't a choice. I added a line of dialogue that explains if Sabrina sets eyes on her mortal mother in the first 2 years after becoming a witch, her mom will turn into a ball of wax. Sabrina's dad adds this policy is how the council discourages marriage between witches and mortals. Back at the pilot table read, the ABC huddle broke. The group rejoined the Viacom folks and me. As president of the network, Jamie Tarsis delivered the notes. She opened by saying she enjoyed all the performances. She liked the animatronic cat. She thought the story worked fine. She did, however, have one fairly major note. I tensed. Jamie felt there wasn't enough conflict between the two aunts. She asked me to describe each one. Zelda's the straight man, logical, restrained, and stable, I said. Hilda's the wild card, emotional, blunt, and an incurable romantic. Jamie thought we needed to push the contrast more, especially in the aunts' attitudes toward their niece. She pitched an idea. What if one of the aunts didn't want Sabrina living with them? What if Hilda's attitude was more like, our lives were so much better before our niece came to live here. She's ruining everything. Jamie's pitch definitely created more conflict, but it felt off to me. I'd been primed to nod and say, let me look at that, but I couldn't see doing any version of this pitch. That just seems sad to me, I said. Sabrina's a teenager. If she's not with one of her parents, and the aunts she's living with don't want her there, how can we laugh? Jamie and I went back and forth. I kept hoping someone from Viacom would back me up, but arguing against a network president is a lonely task. We reached an impasse. I sensed it was my cue to say, okay, I'll try it that way. But before I got the words out, network VP Jeff Bader jumped in and uttered the four most beautiful words in the English language. I agree with Nell. Most networks present as a monolith, so Jeff offering an independent opinion was completely unexpected. His speaking up broke the deadlock. Fine, Jamie said, ready to move on. Leave it. I will always be grateful to Jeff for his creative support at such a crucial moment. From that moment on, the pilot shoot went smoothly, thanks in large part to Robbie Benson's creativity, preparation, and expertise. Robbie even did double duty when he agreed to play Sabrina's dad and had to direct himself. The only small disappointment for me came during the Witch's Council scene. Penn and Teller had flown in from Vegas and were prepared for their parts. Debbie Harry, lead singer of Blondie, flew in from Europe and was a bit bleary, but quickly got up to speed on her lines. The fourth member of the council, Mr. X, had no lines because Mr. X was only 6 months old. I wrote the part with a specific baby in mind. From the moment he was born, our son Rudy had a sunny disposition. As Mr. X, all he had to do was sit and look cute. Rudy got the part. The day of the shoot, Colin brought Rudy to wardrobe, where they dressed him in a custom purple velvet onesie. Mr. X arrived on set looking positively regal. The crew was still lighting the set when out of nowhere, wah! Colin and I exchanged a look. Rudy rarely fussed. Is the outfit bothering him? I wondered. Colin checked the onesie's high neckline. Seems fine. Wah! Does he feel hot to you? Colin asked. I pressed my lips to Rudy's forehead. He was warm. We assumed the polyester onesie was to blame, so we stripped it off him. That didn't help. Rudy was running the first fever of his life. I looked over at Robbie Benson, who was reviewing shots with the camera crew. The scene had multiple speaking parts, special effects, and mechanical props. Adding one more uncontrollable variable would stress the shoot. As executive producer, I made the hard choice to do what was best for the production. I cut my own flesh and blood from the scene. Colin took Rudy straight home. 6 months later, around his first birthday, Rudy made his network debut, appearing as Cupid at the end of the opening credits sequence for our Valentine's Day show. The double meaning of created by Nell Scovell is kind of awesome. After the pilot, the writers started breaking the next 12 episodes in our offices on the Universal lot. The Sabrina writers' room was underneath a parking structure, and every time a car drove in or out, the whole room shook like there was an earthquake. We used to joke that if the big one ever hit, we'd all shrug and figured, eh, it's just a truck, right before the ceiling collapsed and crushed us to death. Closing in on our September 27, 1996 premiere, Sabrina was flying under the radar as ABC focused its promotional efforts on Clueless, a TV adaptation of Amy Heckerling's perfect movie. I worried that TV reviewers who were, and still are, mostly male, might not appreciate our series and its three female leads. Some reviewers did dismiss the show, calling it daft and borderline funny dopey, but a few heavy hitters, like Pulitzer Prize winner Tom Shales, were charmed. Sabrina premiered on a Friday night, and the next morning at exactly 9 a.m., I stood in my kitchen, dialing into the ABC overnight ratings hotline. TGIF shows typically received a 10 to 14 share, percentage, of the audience. I listened as the monotone voice on the hotline droned through the 8 o'clock shows. My heart was pounding as he announced 8:30, ABC, Sabrina the Teenage Witch, premiere, 20 share. I screamed. Over the weekend, I dialed that number over and over and never got tired of hearing that monotone, 20 share, which translated to over 18 million viewers. Within weeks, my hero, an ABC scheduling guru, Jeff Bader, was telling Entertainment Weekly, "Sabrina is the little show that could." My three favorite reviews for Sabrina, the Teenage Witch. Perfectly respectable family fare, yet not so perfectly respectable that it's drippy, Sabrina the Teenage Witch made a bright and sprightly addition to ABC's Friday night. Tom Shales, The Washington Post. Not just TGIF fare, but TV good enough for any night. David Wilde, Rolling Stone. Sabrina is a series with two levels. It's unabashed silliness designed for a young audience. It's nuanced satire, something that adults also may find a kick. Howard Rosenberg, Los Angeles Times. The network flipped our time slot with Clueless. We stayed in the 9 o'clock slot and finished 30th out of 155 shows for the 1996-1997 TV season. More importantly, the Valentine's Day episode fulfilled a dream of mine to get mentioned in TV Guide's Cheers and Jeers column. Even better, it wasn't a jeers. As showrunner, I got to build the writing staff and hired co-executive producer Norma Vela and supervising producers Carrie Honeyblum and Renee Phillips. I'd never worked on a show with so many high-level women. Still, I should have been more inclusive. The Sabrina room had some diversity. A disabled writer, a writer married to a Latino, a Stanford grad, but we didn't have any writers of color. I'm aware of all the excuses I could make to justify the homogeneity because they've all been made against me on male-centric shows. I had the opportunity to include more voices, and I didn't make enough of an effort. That was a mistake. It would have made the show funnier. The cast was all white, too. Early in the pilot process, my CAA agents pitched Cicely Tyson for the part of Aunt Zelda. Tyson is a Tony Award and Emmy Award-winning actress, and I should have jumped at the suggestion. Instead, I said that we were already zeroing in on Caroline Ray, and it wouldn't make sense for the two to be sisters. "It's a world of magic. Maybe one sister is black," my agent said. It would have been an interesting and bold move, but I didn't pursue the idea. The rest of the writing staff included Salem's alter ego, Nick Bakay, who was indispensable and went on to a stellar career in both TV and movies. You can thank Nick for Paul Blart, Mall Cop. Frank Conniff was better known as TV's Frank from Mystery Science Theater 3000. Rachel Lippman had written a classic Rugrats episode. I leaned heavily on co-producer John Sherman, who went on to become an executive producer of Frasier. John and I cracked each other up with smart, dumb jokes like, "Oh good, there's a lecture at MIT on the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. It's either at 8 or at 10 o'clock." On set, Paul Feig was hysterical as Sabrina's biology teacher, Mr. Poole, first name Gene. Watching Gary Halverson direct 6 episodes was a masterclass in how to run a set. Editor Stu Bass made every show funnier. Hey, I never got to make an Emmy speech, so I'm doing it here. The show's tone tended to be my favorite mixture of grounded and absurd. Sabrina's high school football team was nicknamed the Fighting Scallions, a misprint of stallions that the school couldn't afford to correct. We wrote in a giant flan and a lint monster that leapt out of the dryer because we could. We hired guest stars that we wanted to work with, like Bryan Cranston, Henry Gibson, and Donald Faison. Raquel Welch played Sabrina's fun-loving, thigh-high, leather-boot-wearing Aunt Vesta, and helped deliver the show's highest-rated episode. Raquel was a total pro and all-around good sport, who was as enchanting off-screen as on. During breaks, I peppered her with questions. "Who's the biggest flirt you've ever worked with?" I asked. "Richard Burton," she said without hesitation. "He was the best." Then her eyes twinkled as she confided lustily, "I mean, in a closet in a minute." Beth Broderick and Caroline Ray made a fantastic team as Aunts Zelda and Hilda. Beth anchored the plots and accepted the necessary task of laying out exposition. Caroline took the show to comedic heights. Caroline's friendly, upbeat delivery allowed her to say the most insane lines with complete conviction. When Hilda and Drell started a relationship, she explains that if he breaks a date, he always sends a pot roast, which magically appears in the oven. "Flowers wilt," Hilda says. "Say it with beef." It made perfect sense coming out of Caroline's mouth. In another episode, a backfiring spell causes Hilda to grow a thick, luxurious beard. I worried the beard might make Caroline self-conscious, but it had the opposite effect. Caroline sauntered onto the set in a tight shirt, little skirt, and full, bushy beard. I swear she never looked sexier. The original order for 13 Sabrina episodes expanded to 22, and then the network added 2 more. We had some turnover in the writer's room, and with 5 shows left, I hired my friend Barry Marks as a staff writer. Barry had never written for TV, but he'd worked on a video game with Penn and Teller, and I knew he could do the job. Barry moved from New Jersey to the West Coast for a couple of months, subletting an apartment near the Hollywood sign. By the final 2 episodes, I was exhausted. New shows are a lot of work, and having a green staff meant a lot of rewriting. Executive producer Liz Friedman once summed up the experience, "Running a show is like being beaten to death by your own dream." My contract had been for a season, and Viacom offered me a generous but not perfect deal to extend for another. I was on the fence about returning for a variety of reasons, and I didn't have the psychic energy to sort it out while still in production. My goal was to finish strong. The penultimate episode was built around Sabrina and her classmates visiting Salem, Massachusetts. I'd written a detailed outline that the studio and network approved on a Friday. That was the good news. The bad news was the table read was on Monday, which meant I had to write the script over the weekend. That Friday evening around 7, I sent the writers home. It had been a tough day filled with drama, so most people bolted from the room. One writer lingered. "Is there anything I could do to help?" Barry asked. "Thanks," I said. "I'll be fine." Barry flashed me a sweet, kind-hearted smile. We said goodnight and I returned to the set where we shot for another couple of hours. When the set wrapped, I headed home to Colin. We were already in bed at 11 when the phone rang. It was Penn in Vegas. Barry's girlfriend in New York City had just called. She'd been talking to Barry on the phone when he suddenly exclaimed, "Ow, that really hurts," and then cut out. She tried calling back, but the line was busy. She didn't know how to call 911 from out of state, so she called Penn, who was calling Barry's friends in L.A. Another friend, Rich Nathanson, had already reported the emergency. Colin and I jumped in the car. All indications pointed to awful news. Barry was not the type to let anyone worry. Colin drove too fast. I wailed. Police cars were outside the apartment complex when we arrived. Rich was standing on the lawn, his face contorted. We cried as coroners carried a heavy body bag to the van. "There goes our friend," Rich wept. A policeman informed us that Barry had died of natural causes. We later learned that he'd suffered a rupture in his aorta, a congenital defect. He was 40. That was Friday night. I spent Saturday with friends and my family. On Sunday, John Sherman came to my house, and together we turned the Salem witch trial outline into a script. I was so grateful to have John's talent and friendship. The table read was a blur. Barry was so new to the show, most of the crew and actors had no attachment to him. He was like a real-life Star Trek redshirt. That may seem cruel, but the reference would have made Barry laugh. Later that afternoon, I stumbled through a phone call with Barry's parents, telling them how sorry I was and how much we would miss him. I felt guilty that the job had moved him 3,000 miles away. I couldn't imagine their pain. That same week, my lawyer called to say Viacom was pushing for an answer on their latest offer. I asked if we could hold off until the season wrapped. Viacom's business affairs department said no. And this is what I learned. If you're on the fence about signing up for an all-consuming project, and that same week you watch a friend carried out in a body bag, you will determine that life is too short. You will make the choice that allows you to spend precious time with the people you love most. I walked away from Sabrina. There are days when I regret that decision. There were compelling creative and financial reasons to stay. There were also unpleasant aspects of the job that may not have been fixable. Mitch Hurwitz, creator of Arrested Development, once compared running a show to piloting an airplane while the passengers throw rocks at your head. I know that feeling well. You want to turn around and shout, "Hey, if I go down, we all go down." My friend Miriam Trog